Good morning and welcome to the International Connection. We are in the fifth week of a 30-part series on mind control in Canada. Today we're going to hear part two of an interview I conducted with Dr. Colin Ross, a Canadian psychiatrist who has documented the history of CIA mind control experiments. You're listening to 88.1.
One of the things that was going to be done at the UCLA Violence Project and also was going to be done at Vacaville State Prison under separate administrative structure, but which got shut down by public protest, was they were going to implant brain electrodes in violent sex offenders, and then they were going to do two things. They were going to use the electrodes as kind of like an electronic bracelet inside the person's head, so they were going to monitor the person's location because of transmissions from the implanted electrodes. And then they would know if the person had gone out, this is after their discharge from prison, they would know if the person had gone outside their restricted area. Also, they would be able to monitor the person's level of sexual arousal through the brain electrodes. So if the guy was outside his restricted area and was starting to get sexually aroused, what they would do would be then transmit a signal to him that would just paralyze him, just make him like go catatonic or stop in his tracks and not move. And then they would notify the police, who would go pick them up. And there's a book called Violence in the Brain by two of these Harvard brain electrode people. And they discuss maybe using these kind of electrodes to deal with people who are rioting, like the Watts riots and so on that were going on at that time. So there was a whole scheme about how we were going to control bad people in the population that we didn't like.
And this is their own literature and their own documentation that you're getting this information from?
This is all completely published, objective, real, exists type stuff.
And does it go into detail about how the electronic delivery mechanism, is it by satellite or by some kind of radio that they would receive and send signals?
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about the technical side of it, but it was... This is back in the 60s and 70s, so they wouldn't have been doing satellite uplinks on that at that point yet. It would be some sort of line-of-sight radio beam of some kind. Another thing that also is documented, in there's a journal called Defense Electronics. In the July 1993 issue, there's a one-page article there that describes technology that's under development. There's a Russian guy who specializes in this stuff. His name is Igor Smirnov, and it's basically technology for beaming different forms of radiation at people's heads. And there's about four or five MKUltra projects that were on this kind of stuff. So it can be either sound energy, percussion, sound percussion waves, or different types of light and radio frequency and all kinds of different types of energy. So the Igor Smirnov is a specialist in this kind of stuff who has technology that he's developed. He was brought over in March of 1993 to a meeting in Northern Virginia that was attended by the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, I think I remember the list right, one of these might be wrong, but definitely the CIA, definitely the FBI, I think the Defense Intelligence Agency, and I think the National Security Agency, a representative from General Electronics and a representative from one of the universities, who all got together to discuss the possibility of using this technology on David Koresh. And this was during the Branch Davidian siege. And according to the article, the reason they decided not to use this technology on him was problems with software compatibility between the Russian software and the American hardware. And what happened as an upshot at the meeting was that firm called Psycho Technologies that's based in Virginia, I forget which town in Virginia, actually contracted with the Russians to develop this kind of technology for possible American usage. So that's all stuff that's actually real, that's actually going on, that's undergoing some sort of research and development currently. In the MKUltra projects, they also describe implanting brain electrodes in various kinds of animals, including dolphins, and using them as delivery systems for biological and chemical weapons. So that's actually in the CIA materials, and they describe further research to fine-tune those kind of systems that were already in successful operational use.
Do you have evidence of DIA involvement in the mind control experiments? Have you been able to get any DIA documentation?
For listeners who don't know, the DIA is the Defense Intelligence Agency.
I understand that the DIA is something like 10 times the size of the CIA as well?
Actually, the CIA, the director of the CIA controls only about 10% of the financial assets of the American intelligence community, meaning that the CIA is really a tiny fragment of all of military and civilian intelligence in the United States. The National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency are both quite a bit bigger. The answer to your question is yes and no. The no part is I don't have direct documentation of Defense Intelligence Agency mind control contracts, but it's really kind of beside the point because all of these intelligence agencies are all interconnected with each other.
Right.
For instance, the CIA had two programs, MKUltra and MKNaomi, and they got federal funds, which they then put into MKNaomi, and MKNaomi then funded the Special Operations Division at Fort Detrick and Edgware Arsenal to do mind control research. So, and that's the way it is with the radiation experiments, too. The Atomic Energy Commission, Health, Education, Welfare, the CIA, all kinds of different government agencies are all interlinked and interconnected. One of the Defense Intelligence Agency programs was called Stargate. There's a liaison between the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency on that. It was just declassified about roughly within the last year. And there was a program on in December on ABC TV, ABC's Nightline program in December, where Bill Gates, who was a former head of the CIA, one of the guys who was the CIA person who was responsible for liaison between the CIA and the military on Stargate, and one of the guys who was a Stargate contractor, all talking about Stargate, which they admitted ran up until at least 1984 and had funding of at least $20 million, which is probably just the tip of the iceberg. And Stargate was a remote viewing program. So the intelligence agencies, all in an interconnected fashion, spent millions of dollars on remote viewing, which is basically having psychics lie down on a table and try and see what's going on at some location in a foreign country to gather intelligence information. There's a book that was just published by something Joseph, Michael Joseph, I think it is, which is a branch of Penguin, a British branch of Penguin Books, called Psychic Warrior, where a guy describes being one of these remote viewers. A lot of that work was done at the Stanford Research Institute in Palo Alto, California. So I mention that partly because it's interesting, partly because if you think that creating multiple personality disorder is too bizarre and strange to be real, again, you have to look at this LSD, this brain electrode research, some of the sensory deprivation, that Ames leaf room with those anisoconic lenses, using millions and millions and millions of dollars to pay psychics to spy on other countries while lying on tables in the United States. Once you have that context, then creating multiple personality just seems kind of small.
Now, what is, like, I understand that what's driving this was the Cold War, you know, back
right.
From the information that we've got back from the late 50s.
True and not true.
Right, but
let me explain why it's true and not true.
Okay.
Just briefly. That's actually a disinformation setup. The term brainwashing was invented by a man named Edward Hunter, who wrote a book about brainwashing in the early 1950s that I have a copy of. So he invented that term and described how the American pilots and prisoners of war in the Korean War, who were captured by the Chinese and then were made to sign false germ warfare confessions and were converted to being communists, had been brainwashed. And then the whole idea was that the CIA and other intelligence agencies had to figure out how that happened. And Jolly West, Margaret Singer, and Robert Lifton, who testified at the Patty Hearst trial, they all interviewed these returning prisoners of war in the Korean War and became experts on mind control and cult thought reform techniques and so on. So the idea was that because the communists were doing that, we had to figure out how to combat that. So it was mainly defensive, and it was reactive to what the communist Chinese were doing. But that's not true. because G.H. Estabrooks was already doing that stuff in the Second World War, or you know, way before the Korean War. So actually there was an offensive program of mind control by the OSS and other intelligence agencies 10 years before the Korean War. So the whole idea that it was got started because of the Cold War is disinformation. But then it obviously got fueled and entrenched by the Cold War. And then the question becomes, well, the Cold War is over. Why do we need that stuff anymore?
Right.
And I think the answer is severalfold. One is, we in fact do need to have intelligence agencies. The world is not a safe place. And for us not to be living in Siberia and getting sent to labor camps in Siberia, we've got to protect ourselves from all kinds of forces in the world, and to do that we have to have intelligence agencies. So I have no beef with the CIA as such or the existence of intelligence agencies. I think they're essential to maintaining freedom and democracy. But once you've got intelligence agencies, you've got the military and you've got a bunch of budgets, you've got people who, like any federal bureaucrats, have to justify their budgets and their programs and everything. You've got people who are already into this, and you've got actual applications of it. And so it'll just carry on, I think, indefinitely. And the fact that the Cold War is over, I don't see as being a major item in this stuff stopping.
Now, you mentioned in your previous lecture that you, as you said, you don't blame the CIA per se, but the psychiatrists and doctors that are involved in this. Do you not feel that the CIA holds some responsibility in funding and allowing the doctors and psychiatrists to operate?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Like, these people definitely were, I mean, the victims of all of this, definitely did not give informed consent, definitely was unethical, it was harmful, there was damages, they deserve compensation, and the federal government's on the hook for that. And so the idea is not that I'm sort of soft on the CIA or apologetic for them, it's just that I'm basically a psychiatrist, right? So my number one concern is with all this bizarre, unethical, destructive conduct by my colleagues and the medical ethics of it and getting the medical profession under control. So what I think needs to happen is that it should no longer be allowed that psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors have funding from the CIA or the military without the subjects of the research knowing where the money is coming from and knowing that it's not really medical research as such. It's military, intelligence, warfare, psychological warfare, mind control research.
In some of the literature, seems to suggest that Canada was offered up to supply so-called guinea pigs for the U.S. mind control experiments. I'm particularly referring to the Al Memorial at McGill University in Montreal with Dr. Cameron. What do you think has Canada's role been in the U.S. military mind control experiments?
Well, the Canadian Psychiatric Association has put out some disinformation that's been pretty well bought by the Canadian public, and that is that you and Cameron, it was just an isolated incident, happened a long time ago back in the 50s, that he had CIA funding. There were sort of different ethical standards back then. Of course, we wouldn't approve it now, but it was just a one-time deal, and he was such a great man, we can overlook it. Hmm. Well, that's not true, because that research completely violated the ethical standards of the time. But also, it wasn't an isolated incident. In fact, Ewan Cameron wasn't even the only person at McGill at that time with CIA funding. Dr. Raymond Prince was funded through MKUltra Subproject 121 to do anthropological psychiatry research in Nigeria. He didn't know at the time it was CIA money. Donald Hebb, who was the chairman of the Department of Psychology there, did a lot of sensory deprivation experiments funded by Canada's Defense Research Board. When the CIA stopped funding Ewan Cameron's work, Health, Education, and Welfare Canada just picked it up and continued this incredibly unethical, harmful, destructive research that wiped out people's memories for their whole lives. There's a man named Hassan Azima, who was a psychiatrist who died of cancer in his early 40s, who was being groomed to be a mind control researcher who was doing LSD and sensory deprivation experiments at McGill, and who was presenting at conferences where all these other military and CIA-funded people were at. So he was in the loop. James Tyhurst, who in 1951 was part of a committee meeting to oversee bluebird and artichoke in Canada before Ewan Cameron got his money, was also funded by Canada's Defense Research Board. And he did LSD research also at Hollywood Hospital in Vancouver. And a doctor named Ross McLean, who was the director at Hollywood Hospital in Vancouver, attended a CIA-sponsored LSD symposium and described giving LSD to 338 different patients at Hollywood Hospital. So there's a lot of military LSD flowing into Vancouver. Then Abram Hoffer and Humphrey Osmond did a lot of military LSD research in Saskatchewan. And Humphrey Osmond then left and moved down to the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute in Pennsylvania, where Carl Pfeiffer was, which is where the Louis Castillo guy was, who was over in the Philippines and got arrested by the FBI over there. So there's been a lot of connections with Canadian psychiatry. A spin-off of all of that, some of the research is funded by the military or the CIA or whoever, and then that gets published and presented at conferences and talked about, and then other civilian psychiatrists who aren't directly funded by the CIA start doing the same kind of stuff. An example of that was at Penetanguishene Hospital, which is the up on Lake Huron there, where there's basically a heavy-duty facility for people who are criminally insane, not guilty by reason of insanity, unfit to stand trial. In the years about 1968-69, there's four papers published in the Canadian Psychiatric Association Journal, which you can go to any of the medical school libraries in Canada and just pull it off the shelf and read it. A psychiatrist named Elliot Barker, who's still alive, was working there. He invented a little room called the capsule that was about 8 by 10 feet. That he would put prisoners as young as 15, going up into early 30s, in this capsule in groups of either 2 up to 7 at a time, for periods of days up to 11 days at a time, all naked and often on LSD. So there's all these violent offenders, murderers, arsonists, rapists, and so on. And he would have them in this little small capsule, all naked, on LSD, kind of doing rap sessions and therapy groups with each other. And the room would be monitored by other prisoners through the either video link or camera link or through a mirror in the ceiling. And other prisoners were responsible for supplying them food and so on. There was one toilet inside the capsule. And they would be signaled to change from one kind of therapy group to another by changing the color of the light that was shone into the room. So they were in this kind of group sensory deprivation with changing colored lights. And the idea was that this would get through their defenses and they'd get to the real stuff and do real therapy. One of the co-authors on one of these patients is an H.M. Mason, who's at the bottom of the paper. It says that he was a patient at this Oak Ridge facility in Penetang on a ward called F Ward. A documentary was made about it by the CBC. Actually, I have a copy of a video of it. So this H.M. Mason is both one of these patients who are all murderers and arsonists and rapists and so on, who's in this capsule getting LSD, and he's also a co-author on the paper. And then apparently, several of the former inmates lived with Elliot Barker post-discharge, and this H.M. Mason, as far as I can tell, is the same guy as Hank Mason. Hank Mason is on the web page of the Canadian Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, which is just what it says. It's Canadian Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children. The current president is Elliot Barker, and this Hank Mason has got who's identified as a founding member of the society, has a little statement about child abuse on the webpage. So it would appear that the Canadian Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children has had executive members who are former violent criminals in a facility for the criminally insane and currently being run by psychiatrists who did all this kind of research, who published it in the Canadian Psychiatric Association Journal.
Interesting.
Just the kind of stuff that it goes on and on and on and on and on with more stories like this.
What's your sense of how many Canadian centers and doctors that were involved in the experimentations?
Well, absolute minimum of 5 to 10.
Mm-hmm. Centers or locations?
Doctors and centers. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, for sure there was McGill, Weyburn, Saskatchewan, and the University of Saskatchewan, Hollywood Hospital, another hospital in Montreal, where LSD was researched. I think, I forget if it was Montreal General. I think it was Montreal General, but I'm not sure about that. I have it documented somewhere. Then the same kind of stuff, apparently not funded by the military or intelligence community, was going on at Penetang.
Is there any indication that experiments were being done on military bases themselves?
Not documented evidence, but there's quite a few accounts from patients that are unverified.
Right. You mentioned that like some of the doctors that were involved in this research were unwitting. What kind of funding institutes were set up to fund this kind of research to unwitting doctors?
Well, they used what they called cutouts. A cutout is a front funding organization. The three major ones were the Human Ecology Foundation, the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation, and the Geschichter Medical Fund.
So each of these would be funded from the CIA, and then in turn they would fund
right,
CIA
and the people
projects.
Who were running those organizations knew that it was CIA money, and often themselves got grants from the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys who was on the board of the Human Ecology Foundation, who reviewed grants for the Human Ecology Foundation, and himself got an MKUltra grant and had top secret clearance, was Carl Rogers. That's kind of amazing, because Carl Rogers is best known for client-centered therapy, which is a kind of humanistic valuing the spiritual worth of the client kind of therapy, where you have to have accurate empathy, unconditional positive regard for the person, and genuine empathy. So it's like the stereotype most humanistic touchy-feely psychotherapy going, and he was actually top secret cleared and funding secret CIA mind control research.
Now, there's a lot of doctors and some therapists out there that dismiss the idea of multiple personalities, and one of the things that some of these people are saying is that it doesn't exist and that it's actually temporal lobe epilepsy. What is temporal lobe epilepsy, and how is it similar to MPD?
Well, temporal lobe epilepsy is just a form of epilepsy that takes place in the temporal lobe of your brain. So there's abnormal electrical discharges that cause you to have a seizure. A typical temporal lobe seizure lasts for 30 to 90 seconds. You may become unconscious or just get a kind of foggy state of consciousness, and you'll usually like fumble at one of your buttons or smack your lips or turn your body in a very kind of mechanistic, over and over, same little motion kind of way. And then you pop out of it after 39 seconds usually. So temporal lobe epilepsy is completely unrelated to multiple personality disorder. That's just a bogus prejudice. And there's a bunch of research that I and others have done that show that the symptom picture of temporal lobe epilepsy and multiple personality are completely different from each other.
Why would these people be making these claims? What would be, you know, why the confusion?
Because they don't take accurate histories. They're very vague about what they say. And they just look grasping at straws for some way to discredit multiple personality, basically. The more serious criticism is that multiple personality is often unwittingly created by bad therapists. Now, that I agree with, and I've actually testified about that in court, that in cases where I'm testifying for the patient who's suing the therapist, and I'm stating as an expert witness that, yes, this was created by the therapist, and yes, all these memories were false, and yes, it did all this harm.
Now, this is a very complex issue and one that's being hotly debated by the public.
The main thing is that there actually is a whole bunch of science about multiple personality and dissociation. It's not just a matter of belief. There's a big literature now that has flaws in it and so on, but there's actually a whole bunch of science. It's not just I believe or I don't believe.
Mm.
The curious twist in the logic is that actually I think that all of this documentation that the military and the CIA have been creating experimental multiple personality and using it in operations actually proves that multiple personality is real. It proves two things. One is that unless they're just wasting money, they're not going to bother with the whole exercise unless you actually can create a new identity that actually is hidden behind a real memory barrier. Otherwise, there'd be no point, right?
And that could be used operationally.
Right. So then none of it's actually really, really, really real. It's all illusions inside your mind. There isn't literally another person in there. But nobody in the multiple personality field is saying that it's literally real anyway to start with. But you can create this artificial second identity, and it can actually do stuff that the main part of the person doesn't remember. That has to be true, otherwise there would be no point in creating it for military use. And so that proves two things. One is that it's possible to create multiple personality by mistake in a bad therapy, that mimics a lot of the conditions of military mind control or cult mind control. But also, if you have a disorder that can be created deliberately, either be it by the CIA, by a destructive cult, by a therapist who doesn't really know what they're doing, or even by the person themselves, then it's not really a big jump to imagine that, it could also happen just naturally and spontaneously as a way of coping with trauma.
Right.
So the very fact that you can create it artificially, to me, indicates that it can be created artificially by mistake or on purpose, and also that it's likely to happen naturally.
Well, the other question is how they manage to create it artificially. Is it a traumatic...
Well, I'm writing about all of this now. I have a number of case histories that describe it in quite a lot of detail. There's a lot of information about how they created Tanya and Patty Hearst. It's very detailed. There's a very good case from Denmark, a guy named Palle Hardrup, who was in jail in the, late 40s in Denmark. Another prisoner named Bjorn Nielsen used a whole lot of mind control and hypnosis techniques and created this amnesic bank robber. And Palle Hardrup actually went out and robbed a bank, and then he robbed another bank, tried to rob a second bank, shot two people, didn't get away with any money, got captured. And the net outcome of the huge trial with 50 witnesses and all kinds of psychiatric testimony and so on, the net outcome of it was that this Bjorn Nielsen guy was found guilty and sentenced to jail, even though he wasn't physically present at any of the robberies. And Palle Hardrup was found kind of an equivalent of not guilty by reason of insanity. And they specifically said at the trial, all the experts did, that this Bjorn Nielsen guy used hypnosis and other methods to create a split identity in Palle Hardrup. So these kind of cases have actually come to trial, and there's a lot of detail on them.
What would these other methods be, and what would the links be between the methods used for artificially creating multiple personalities and childhood trauma?
Well, the links are severalfold. One is you have to have a pretty good control over the person's life space. You can't just see them for half an hour a week, and that's all that's required. So in the Palle Hardrup case, these two guys were cellmates, and also they worked in the same workshop, and were basically with each other constantly for about 18 months. If you can isolate the person from the outside world, from contact with other people who are going to be critical of what's going on or give a different point of view, that's helpful. These things apply to destructive cults and also deliberate creation of multiple personality. Then if you can use all kinds of thought reform techniques, that is, getting the person to study doctrine, do all kinds of meditation exercises, chanting exercises, hypnotic focusing exercises, internal dream imagery exercises, you get their mind kind of into a trance state and focused on what you want them to believe and focus on. And then you actually use formal hypnosis or drugs, and then you deliberately instruct them that you want to create a second identity, and then you figure out what is it that this person's going to be motivated by. So in the Palle Hardrup case, this Bjorn Nielsen guy created Guardian Spirit X, and whenever Bjorn Nielsen was speaking to Palle Hardrup, it was actually X who was talking through Bjorn Nielsen. And he got Palle Hardrup to buy into that because he was interested in all kinds of New Age type stuff. And then X started teaching him the path to enlightenment. And so the basic motivator was that he was going to get to enlightenment. And if he didn't follow the doctrine, didn't follow the rules, didn't follow all the tests, and didn't perform adequately, then he would lose X, and he would lose his path to enlightenment. And that was the thing that he was most obsessed with. So that was the carrot that kept him going. So you have to find some sort of carrot that'll keep the person going. And then you can use any number of different kinds of behavior modification techniques, which could be punishing the person if they say what you don't want them to say, rewarding them if they say what you do want them to say. And I could go on with the list a little bit, but basically you have to get control over the person's thoughts, over their life space, and you have to set up a reward and punishment system to steer them along the path you want so that they become kind of robots who just repeat the doctrine that you want. And then if you want to create the second identity, you can use all kinds of threats, or you can use actual trauma and fear. And the trauma and the fear and the agitation and the upset drive the splitting of the mind just naturally. Because the human mind tends to split or dissociate in some way to cope with trauma all the time.
Right.
Whether it be a plane crash or natural disaster or sexual assault in adulthood. And then the other ingredient with children is that their minds just seem to be more susceptible to this kind of splitting process. The child's mind tends to do that naturally.
You're listening to 88.1. We'll be right back with the second half of this interview with Dr. Colin Ross right after this.